And welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
And this time I'm the one who's dying.
See, it's transmissible through podcasts, so be warned, listener, be warned, you're next.
Now, and I know some of y'all are thinking that that couldn't possibly be a thing, but I would like to point out that if you go back through the history of the show, there was an episode where we kind of had to rush through the review because Crash was dying from a severe migraine. And then the recording the following week, Vita and I both were struggling through migraines.
Mm-hmm. It's prophetic. It's like clockwork. I take it first, and I make it far more worse, and I pass it on to you. That's extra value.
Can I get a refund?
Not for another year. So you'll have to wait until next New Year's Eve, and who knows what might happen, especially since today, our first official movie review of the year, and only 16 days late. No, it's fine. It's fine. We're doing New Year's Evil.
One night, they were celebrating New Year's Eve. He was out, ending their life.
I'm going to commit murder at midnight. Call me Evil.
Every New Year's Eve, the caller came out.
From 1980, this is just like a basic slasher film. There's nothing too fancy-dancy about this. But at the time, and still a lot of people who see it, do not appreciate this film. No one appreciated this film. This film was unappreciated by almost everyone on many levels. And you know what? I kind of really liked it.
For me, this was something that another podcast that I've listened to and I've mentioned a fair number of times on here, Junk Food Cinema, they always reference it around like the new year. And I think they actually covered it probably a couple of years ago. But it just became one of those movies that just gets mentioned over and over and the title gets stuck in the back of your head.
I mean, it's a great title.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
not many things that you can do with New Year's Eve aside from like either a porn parody, a religious thing, or evil. That's kind of it. With Halloween and Christmas and other, you know, holidays, there's a few more aspects that you can play with to create kind of, you know, good fun, you know, titles. Jokes, situations. New Year's Eve is pretty straightforward, and so like, good on them for laying claim to such a fantastic title. And I would say, in any other world, it would be better served as an album name. But this kind of is. This is like, okay, yeah. Here's where I think the break between my enjoyment of this film and probably a lot of people's enjoyment of this film and how it was taken originally by the audience. People were expecting a movie, you know, a film, cinema, a feature film in the sense of like a beginning, middle, and end that's pretty decent. And it has a story displayed in moving pictures that you watch in a theater. That's fine. That's cool. Yeah, technically it is that for sure. But no, I think those people fundamentally misunderstand what this is. This movie, and it's fantastic that it came out at the time it came out. This movie is a long run music video. And any other approach completely misunderstands it.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Like, visually, I was getting almost an exploitation vibe from it.
Yes, but absolutely.
At the same time, and I think this was a lot of the scenes at the concert that was doing this, but I was also getting such a Rocky Horror vibe that I would love if this were to be remade. You don't do it as a horror movie, you do it as a musical.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it really, if you're talking about diegetic music, this is a musical. It's got musical moments throughout. It has numbers. It's just that because the conceit of the film is built around this New Year's Eve talent show or concert or whatever being broadcast over TV and radio out of LA, featuring quote unquote punk and new wave bands. One is semi new wave, the other is a pretty decent 70s metal band, but no, you are not punk. you are a really decent late 70s metal band. No doubt. Shadow had that shit down.
Yeah.
Why they are considered punk, that leads into the exploitation aspect of this, where like someone was like, let's make a punk horror film. And because at the time in LA in 1980 and the late 70s, the scene was young but strong. And this is the scene that would eventually go on to birth a hell of a lot of alternative punk and like a fuck ton of just really, really hardcore stuff. Like literally the genre hardcore comes from a spinoff of these people before it eventually becomes surfer punk. Anyway, the less said about Blink 182 the better. But this is like a time capsule of both the music at the time, not punk music, to be clear. Oh, yeah. There's no punk music in this. There's a lot of new wave, some ska, mostly metal, but if you're looking at those music, at that those genres of music at the time, it's a fantastic time capsule. And it's more importantly a time capsule about what you could make a movie about. You could get a horror slasher flick filmed in downtown LA if it was filled with a bunch of like David Bowie at the height of David Bowie levels of makeup punks. There are looks in this that are literally airbrushed. That's the only way you can blend like that.
Yeah.
Our main character, ostensible main character, Blaze, the host of this quote unquote punk rock New Year's, which they're calling New Year's Evil. And like everything about this is fantastic. The music is wrong. But everything else is just spot on. The kids all look right. Blaze needlessly like looks like someone in their 40s pretending to be someone in their 30s so they can host a show, because this is all I've got, damn it. I used to be famous and this is all I got. I'm not leaving LA. Mm-mm. And from their spirals, violence, drama, gore, and more drama It's kind of funny how like self-contained all of this nonsense is. So long story short, Blaze gets a call because it's a call-in show. Ooh, yeah, and they, you know, back in the day, you could call
once TV upon a time
whatever you want. Yeah. And a murderer tells her, "Hey, I'm going to kill someone every New Year's until, you know, in the United States. For every New Year's that there is, I'm going to kill someone. And, you know, probably end up killing you. Just, you know, just to let you know." And all of this is, of course, broadcast on television or radio. And the cops barely care. They barely care. I mean, even everyone involved at the first point is just like, "Oh, great, a crank." It's like, if a guy calls in saying he's gonna murder, I'm not gonna be like, "He's a crank." I'd be like, "We're just gonna take him off the air now. Thank you. Thank you." Yeah. Instead of laying him
now,
repeat.
Two things. First of all, just to be clear, when Crash says every New Year's, that's New Year's in each time zone across the states.
Yeah, so like you begin on the East Coast and you end up in Hawaii, because of course people forget Hawaii, and that adds a lot of New Year's. Hawaii.
I mean, Hawaii time zone wise is basically America's Newfoundland.
Yeah. Except you can go there in the winter.
Yeah. Now, second thing that I do want to note right now is that during that call, he specifically says that every hour he's going to kill someone close to Blaze until he gets to her.
It's keep a very direct threat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. To which she doesn't bother to tell anyone close to her the threat. She just like implies that it'd be nice if they weren't alone. Like, she has a son in the building, in her like ready room, and he's being a brat. He's being a weirdo. You find out why later, but he's being a goddamn brat. And she's just, she doesn't say, "We just received a threat at the studio. We don't know how legitimate it is or not. So we're going to try to like make sure that everyone's together. Security will be there for you. But before that, can you just come on down? Can you just like join us?" Because again, everyone I know has just had their life threatened by a guy who called in saying, you know, like he's going to murder a bunch of people. No, she doesn't share that. She just goes, "Hey, it'd be nice if you came down here." And when her son replies with, "I've got something important to tell you," she suddenly switches gears and goes, "Oh, that's nice, goodbye," and hangs up. And she hangs up. She is calling her son to let him know there is a murderer on the loose. And she hangs up because he starts like getting slightly awkward and would like to actually have a conversation with her instead of be talked at. Red flag one. Keep that in mind.
Oh, yeah, no, and like there is going to be so much. Keep this in mind, because I am convinced that somewhere there is an extended cut of New Year's Evil, because there are so many instances where there was something that should have happened on camera, but doesn't.
Yeah, I wonder, like, when I was reading old classic reviews of it, a lot of people were saying it's like, "Oh, it's so gory, it's so gory, it's so gory." And it's like, it really isn't. And that's even by 1980 standards. It's really not gory. Yeah. And so I was actually wondering if some things literally got cut from, like, the main copy of this film. Like, if they're like, "Okay, fine, you won't show it in your theater, we'll remove it. We'll remove it." It's like, did you save any of that footage? Why would I save it? It's not like someday they're going to come up with some way to turn my movie into, like, energy particles in the air and you could just re-edit things whenever you want. Fuck you. It does seem that, like, this film is missing scenes and by that, I don't mean that the storyline feels like it's jumping around or anything. You can follow it very well. You can see where the strands are leading. You're like, oh, okay, that's interesting. That's weird. That's random. I assume all these things are tied together. And when they tie together at the end, yes, it makes sense. There is a quote-unquote reveal, twist, flourish, but and it works. It does. It does. It's just, as you say, where's the fucking gristle? Where is the meat between these bones that I can get my fucking teeth into and have the blood drip down?
Yeah, like, I'll give you one like really flagrant example. When Blaze and her agent first meet up with the cops, and she mentions her assistant Yvonne, who at this point is already dead because she was the standard open and kill in the movie. And she's talking about how like Yvonne's missing, she's worried about her, and this is the first time the cop has heard the name Yvonne, at least as far as we as the viewer know. But he's clearly acting like he already knows who this person is.
Oh yeah, no, there's definitely a few things where it's like something was left on the cutting room floor, or the script needed one more pass by someone with a critical view to point out, like, okay, but it seems like this character already knows this. This character, for some reason, doesn't know this or doesn't care. What the fuck? I mean, again, at another point, she tells her son, Yvonne has gone missing. These threats have been made. Please do the math yourself and show up. And instead, he just doesn't, is aloof, and then acts weird. And like, again, there is a reason for that, and it's not only to make you suspicious of him, it does turn out in the end. It works out, it plays out, and it fits. But at the time, you're kind of like, what the fuck is with this lady? Why does she not give a crap? Because she barely gives a crap. She seems to remember that, like, every now and then, oh, right, I'm involved in a movie plot. I have to actually inquire about that. I'm the active one in this, aside from the murderer. And I love how they always show you the murder. There's no mystery to any of this. There technically is a reveal, but you see the murders being done and who's doing them, and it's just like, oh, I see. It's DC animated universe logic. I finally know the identity of the Flash. I have no idea who this is. I know the identity of the murderer. I have no idea who this is.
No, but at the same time, though, Kip Niven, who played Richard Sullivan, the murderer, in terms of acting performance, that man walked so Michael Shannon could run.
Oh, yeah. No, there's something very, very like 70s, 80s creeper man about it that Michael Shannon has been drawing from for a very long time.
I mentioned my desire for a remake. If this were to happen, I want Michael Shannon as the killer.
That would work. That would work very well. Yeah. Good Lord. Everything about this is like really well done for having practically no budget. It was made for $500,000 dollars, but the sets are, I don't know if they're sets. They look like they're actual rooms in houses and buildings. Like, there's this middle ground when it comes to budget where either you can afford sets and they look cheap as shit and they shake when you know, close a doorway, or you can't afford sets, but you can afford to actually rent, like, entire apartments to shoot in. So everything looks real, but you've done it on the extra super cheap. I wonder which this is, because there's a lot of really well done work in terms of like making a movie. The beginning of it is, I swear to God, I feel like it is a tongue-in-cheek homage to American Graffiti. And it is shot similarly on the fucking, on like Rodeo. What the hell? That should have been, like, I assume it was shot illegally. There's no goddamn way they were paying for this. But they did it so well that you can't tell that, like, this is a terrific, this is a movie that is funded half-assed, but shot full-ass. Full ass and a half went into the production at a half-ass scale budget.
Yeah, no, like, there's so much of this movie that takes place at a hotel that, to go back to your earlier point, they rented a banquet hall at a hotel and did that up. Because, like, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. And it's a really smart way of doing a film like this. You only have a couple of rooms, so make one a big room that you can remake however you need. Get a couple of different looking hotel rooms that you can, you know, shuffle around. Here's an office. Here's a bathroom to murder someone in. Here's another bathroom to murder someone in. But there's a lot more going on. There is an intricate, and by intricate, I mean, how the fuck did you pull this off? Intricate stunt involving an elevator. And it's not like, it's not green screen. They didn't have the money for blue screen, my bad. They didn't have money for blue screen, but also you can tell it's not blue screen. Like, there's none of the shading or the weirdness around her as she's hanging there from a chain. And when you look away, it's not like rear projection. I swear to God, I think they actually attached an actress to, like, some kind of cable car and fucking went.
Yeah, no, I was just saying, like, with this movie's apparent love of almost extreme close-ups.
Yeah.
I could honestly comfortably assume that a lot of that was probably shot, like, upward from maybe, like, the second floor, give or take. And then it just slowly lowered her, but it's so close that you can't tell where in the elevator shaft they actually are.
Yeah, you can just tell that they are moving. That elevator shaft and elevator is real. And whoever that is hanging on to it, they are not A, mannequin, B, a stuntman in a dress. I swear to God, they took the actress and were just like, yep, hold on to this.
Oh, yeah, no, like, I think just the simple fact that we have a slasher movie where my favorite kill is not even an actual kill.
Yeah, it's kind of special. It's a fantastic potential kill that doesn't work. It's just, okay. Okay, ballsy to put so much effort into a shot, like a situation, and to have it not pan out in gore. Smart. Because it just ups the tension for the entire thing.
And just, like, just the very simple, your final big, before you see it, presumed kill, is to essentially have your main character be dropped, quote, to their death, as though they're the New Year's ball on New Year's.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Again, like, a lot of fun went into this script that at this movie's level of investment and involvement, it shouldn't be putting in this much effort. That's what really the theme of this entire review is this movie put in A for effort. It doesn't matter how anything else turned out because, like, it tried. It tried so hard. It gave you a soundtrack that kicked far beyond any right to.
Yeah.
It does neon slasher filming beautifully. The outfits in this are perfect to draw your eye, keep the attention, give you a sense of a time and a place. It's small little things like the mosh pit. Usually when you see a mosh pit in a movie or TV, there's something choreographed about it or something very sanitized. And it's like, no, your actors trying not to hurt each other, et cetera, et cetera. I suspect that mosh pit in this movie was filled with kids from the LA punk and metal scene that they were just like, hey,
oh, no doubt.
You want to be in a movie?
No doubt.
Because one, they're going at each other just like in a real mosh pit. Trust me. I know. But also just like in a real mosh pit, they are not in tune with the beat of the rhythm of the song or anything. You can't tell what connection their movement has with the song being played. That's a proper mosh pit.
Oh, not only that, and like there are points where I don't know if you caught this, but with the mosh pit scenes, there are points where the camera is zoomed in on them so that you can see the moshers, and the moshers all look like they are not aware of the world around them at all. They have tuned out from reality completely. They are utterly zombified. And the fact that the sound guy kept the sound of the shuffling feet.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to publicly thank them for that.
Yeah, it's one of those things of either you did a lot of Foley work for this film, or they went through the extra effort, because the two bands that appear in the show, in the movie, are also are two real bands that also did the soundtrack. So, like, you see them perform the song, that's them actually performing the song. And I wonder if essentially this segments of this film were shot by actually putting on this New Year's Evil concert, more or less, and just letting the evening go. Just being like, yeah, we'll have the actress come in to announce the songs and everything. That's actually her announcing to the audience. That's the audience. They went to a show. They played 12 fucking songs in this whole thing. And it's the tiny details, like the feet shuffling, that it's just, yeah, yes, it can be Foley'd in. Absolutely. I don't expect that from this film. Considering how much extra effort this film puts into it, sure, they might have done it. But I see this film, and I think all that extra effort would have gone instead into throwing a hell of a great, like, show that happened to be filmed for a movie. It's like there's probably a cut scene here where it's just like, you guys enjoying the show? Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, you might see some cameras around. What they're doing is they're filming this for a slasher film. You're in a horror movie. Yeah. All right. Here's Shadow. You know, it's like I can see that happening. I think I've actually been to a fucking show where that happened. It's vague and hazy, but everything about it just looks so real. It's like, yes, this would be a fun party to be at. Everything, I don't know, there's a magic going on that, and details in the background that they don't even go into. There's aesthetic choices in this that are clearly driven by someone else's creative choices entirely separate from this film. And they just make it a more rich, lived-in world instead of distracting.
Yeah, no, and also, just to add to the little things, just those moments of seeing the killer, like, prepping his disguise or, like, putting stuff away. Like when I watched the original Mission Impossible from the 60s, one of my favorite things was those moments of seeing Martin Lando, like, studying footage of the person he was going to impersonate, figuring out what the mask needed to look like and so forth. And getting stuff like that here, like that moment of him putting on the fake mustache and suddenly having a whole Burt Reynolds thing going, which was also interesting in and of itself.
It was very, very Reynolds-y. Very, very Reynolds. There are some amazing tracksuits in this. I can't under appreciate any of the outfits in this movie at all. They're all amazing, but like there are some A number one early 80s tracksuits. Something that is, you haven't quite reached the Adidas tracksuit of the 80s, but you still have the kind of like fly flared out epaulets on it. So like tracksuit 70s epaulette, tracksuit 70s epaulette. Ugly. I love it.
And also, just to add to the tracksuits, just the fact that towards the end of the movie, our killer is suddenly doing one hell of a visual Caitlyn Jenner impression.
Yeah, that went weird. And then like a really odd way, because it's not meant to be like the obvious reveal that, say, you'd have at Sleepaway Camp. No, it's just, you just look like that for some fucking reason. I don't know. Why? I don't know. Why? It's a crit. The reveal of this, I swear to God, yeah, like, a lot of this film had me thinking the whole time, okay, like, there's gonna be some sort of gay panic reveal to this. There's gonna be some sort of gay panic reveal. You could feel it coming, and then it doesn't. And instead, it's purely just, mother didn't love me. Mm.
I mean, in a lot of ways, I think the single ballsiest thing that this movie does is at the very end, where it's just like, you actually thought you were going to get a sequel. I love you.
I didn't read that as a sequel. I read that as a, it's your cutaway kill, where it's implied that within the next 5 minutes, she is dead. You know?
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. That's how I took it, is just like, you're supposed to infer from that, oh, no, there was one more left, and bitch got hers.
I mean, I can see it going like, with the son putting on the father's mask, and also speaking of the son and taking into account the fact I have not considered ages in any of my casting choices here. But that dude,
yeah, neither did they.
Chris Pine.
But yeah. It took me a good couple of minutes when we first have that interaction between the mother and the son to be sure that, okay, they are not fucking. They are indeed mother and son. Yeah. Because one, the performers are within the same age range. That's kind of weird. Two, there's, and like this lends to the weirdness and creepiness of the relationship. Absolutely. But there is a whole lot of Oedipus in that room right now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Grant Kramer, who was the son, Derek, that man is in his own movie for 90% of New Year's Evil. And he's
like, literally, his scenes have nothing to do with anything. No. Yeah.
He's off to the side doing some fine work.
Oh, fine work. Fantastic. Yeah. Like Silence of the Lambs level weirdness. Very psycho. Very excellent tormented lunatic performance that is essentially just like a script from like an audition book. It has nothing to do with this fucking movie. Does it make you worry about the sanity of his character and presume he's gonna kill? Yeah, absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Does that then run into the fantastic contrary work of the film to show the killer the whole time? So you're just like, so what is this kid's problem? I mean, I assume he's the killer, but I know he's not the killer. But oh wait, he's the killer, but also not really. It's really fascinating how they tied it all together in a way that is like, that's ridiculous. That is silly, silly, willy, billy, killy, ridiculous. But also, I feel because of the extremes of his performance, it's like, ah, that makes sense as a plan to you. And you're fucking nuts.
Yeah, it's like he's there to be like, he's there for as the red herring. Nobody told the writer when to stop using him as the red herring.
Oh my god! All I can think of are like how every other actor in Usual Suspects thought they were the bad guy. I'm Kaiser Soze. It's obvious from the script. I'm Kaiser Soze.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, oh, this guy was mad Kaiser Soze. And then, like, the writer forgot that they were writing him that way. And so by the end of the movie, they're still Kaiser Soze, but also not. And so they had to just be like, fuck. It was my brilliant scheme the whole time. I love when his father, who is even more insane. Like, these are two very deranged people. I can understand, like, the movie kind of wants you to see like, oh, she's a neglectful bad mother and she doesn't, you know, she doesn't deserve this, but there is she did set this in motion somewhat. And it's like, yeah, kind of, but also, her ex-husband is clearly insane and her son is clearly insane. And this is clearly dominant on the Y gene or the Y chromosome. Oh, yeah. This is not her fault. Stop movie trying to make this her fault. Is she a bitch? Yeah, kinda. Is that a reason for death? No.
I didn't even read that she was a bitch so much as she's trying to like give her son attention, but she's being pulled in so many directions at once. And she's spinning so many plates at the same time, and she's not good at it.
Yeah, and by bitch, I suppose I'm trying to look at in the measure of what 1980 would have expected, and by having her son look like Yacht Club Ken, and have her look like fucking like. Garbage can Sid and Nancy, I think they're trying to assert that she is an irresponsible parent who is ignoring her family while trying to chase like fame and youth. That's why like she has such ridiculous makeup that is clearly drawn from the children of this era by the fact that we just saw a car full of kids with the same makeup, including two men. And I think the whole thing is supposed to suggest to you that, like, she's an irresponsible, deviant mother. And the insanity that comes from all of, like, the rejection her rejecting her husband and her rejecting her kid, chasing fame is supposed to be and that's why, you know, she got hers. And it's like, yeah, I can see that from 1980s perspective. Oh God. Like if this was 1982, I would 100% say Reaganism happened. Reaganism, Reaganism, Reaganism. But Ronnie ain't in fucking charge yet.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, you can either hate her character or you can sympathize with her character, and both of those work.
Yes. And I think that on some level you are supposed to sympathize with her, but on another level, they really did not give her any like hero moments.
No.
That this isn't like she's not Sarah Connor. Yeah, she's not Sarah Connor.
Oh, fuck no. I mean, I think before this, I believe the actress's biggest claim to fame was being one of the Fonz's girlfriends.
Hey! She was in the same room as Ron Howard at some point.
Oh, there's some 6 degrees for you.
There you go. yeah, no, I fucking love this film, but once again, I'm looking at it through the veneer of this is an hour and 20 minute long music video, like an almost an almost pre MTV music video, only because it literally was shot before MTV, but I think it came out after MTV had started. So it's like in that sweet middle ground where what do kids want? Contemporary music in video form. What does this give them? More or less contemporary music in video form with chapters punctuated with brutal violence. And it might be the most brilliant way of doing like an anthology of punk and metal songs. It's just do the song, have it switch to a little bit of like someone trying to get away. They get murdered. Next song. And just keep moving up. Essentially like Muppet Show the fucking thing. Just Muppet Show it. Stage show. Drama behind. Stage show, drama behind.
Yeah, yeah.
And it crescendos at the very end with the last song going into, like, the final kill. I wish that it had stuck to that. It eventually abandons the music and the show entirely, somewhat. The music stops being diegetic and just becomes, like, it's our soundtrack. Fuck off. And that was my one area of disappointment is that like they didn't tie that fantastic almost kill to what was going on her TV show where the bands were playing. That would have been just that extra level of like craft. And that's not me complaining about the movie. No, it's just me noticing a thing.
Yeah. And I mean, while we're noticing stuff, forget dropping the soundtrack. They forgot the kill every hour on New Year's concept.
Yeah, whenever they remembered it, or maybe they miscounted time zones.
Oh no, he missed the Colorado kill completely, and nobody remarks on it.
Or, like, it doesn't come to the next one being a double kill or something. Yeah, there should have been some aspect where the film is aware of itself more. Or is that, like, aware of the audience's presumption and perspective on it. Because, like, yeah, the other characters may not mention something, but the audience will be like, wait a minute. I've been robbed. Murder someone.
And I mean, this could go back to the whole cutscenes thing that we were talking about earlier, because there's no kill around Colorado celebrating New Year's, but the police presence at the hotel is still ramping up the protection as though his kills are continuing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you were right. Something hit the cutting room floor that was, I wouldn't say it's intrinsic. It's not like the film falls apart, but
no.
Mayhaps someone got a little slap happy with the old splicey.
Yeah, it could be, but I mean, there's just something about this movie where by the time you get to that point, and even if you do notice it, like I did, and I don't care.
Yeah, it doesn't affect the overall film. It doesn't affect the plot. It doesn't affect anything that we're here for, which is, at this point in time, Murder and Good Tunes. And you've gotten a lot of good tunes at this point. You've gotten a decent amount of murder, and there is still more murder to come. Relatively. Not as much murder. You've passed the hump of murder. But diminishing returns of murder from this point on.
Yeah.
But you get the reveal. And the reveal's fun, and it makes everything go, oh, okay, that makes sense. Because I was wondering, what the fuck?
Oh yeah. And also, just to give further credit to the late Kip Niven, who passed away in 2019. Sir, while we're on the subject of reveals, you may have achieved one of the greatest jump scare moments in the history of horror films. So, you remember when he picks up dumb blonde number one, Sally, at that bar, and then you know she comes out and he discovers that she's bringing her roommate with her. And the fact that there's a subtle facial expression where you can see him going, fuck.
Yeah.
I can't. I appreciate him so much for that. But they go to the convenience store. The roommate goes in to use the bathroom. And that's when he takes the opportunity to kill Sally for his New Year's kill. Roommate comes out. And we also discover that our killer has the kind of foot fetish that could get Quentin Tarantino the role in the remake.
Because he leaves
the shoes.
I think if I recall, the last time this was in theaters, an actual theater, was at Quentin Tarantino's theater in L.A. Like, he put on a big show for this, and it's like, I wonder why.
Oh no! Even without the whole shoe fetish, I could still totally see Tarantino being into something like this.
Oh, absolutely! Especially since he would have been roughly the age of I think he would have been just a little younger than like some of the punks in this film, and
yeah,
it's L.A. Like, I'm sure that so much of that was, like, just very familiar. It's, a very familiar film to him, I bet. You know, like, in terms of location, people, fashion, all of that. I'm surprised that he hasn't remade this, quite frankly.
That's probably a valid point.
Just purchase it. Yeah.
Like I said, the roommate comes out of the convenience store, discovers that the car is now gone. Spots Sally's shoe, panics, follows it toward the dumpster, sees, I think, the sleeve of Sally's dress hanging out the dumpster, goes over, opens it to look inside, and that's when our killer flicks his lighter and pounces, and that is just so well lit and well shot it's beautiful.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic, and just again, this is a film that had no expectations. It didn't need to go so hard, but they were smart about it. They had fun. This is a movie that had a lot of goddamn fun.
When I did my first watch through about a week ago, I got to the end of the movie and I'm sitting there going, this movie should not work, but I am so damn satisfied right now.
Yeah, I was very happy by the end of it, for sure. But I could tell that I was going to get what I wanted out of it by the time the second song hit. I mean, obviously, New Year's Evil is itself, the song New Year's Evil is itself a cult classic.
Oh, yeah.
Late 70s, early 80s, kind of pop metal, if one must, track. It's very, very fun. And it's
I would put that thing right up there with Dream Warriors.
Oh yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah, absolutely. And it's one thing to have a good song, as you say, Dream Wars. It's one thing to have one good song. That's where you threw all your money at. The second that they hit their second song and it was just as much of a bop, and then their third song, it was just as much of a bop. It's like, okay, this is a special fucking movie. Even if I do not care about the film itself, I immediately am like, I am here for this music. This is fantastic. This is like a snapshot. Time and a place. I love it. I just wish they hadn't called it punk.
No, fair, fair. It's, I think it's that early 80s period where I think a lot of people just really did not know what punk truly was.
Mm-hmm. And like the visuals of the quote unquote punks in it are on. Yeah, those are punks, all right. Especially a lot of queer punks, especially. Like you're right, there is a Rocky Horror feel to this that is not intentional, but it's that great middle ground where like punk and queer and rock and roll meet. And it just, what happens is it coalesces into like Tim Curry, a young Tim Curry in makeup and leather. And you're just like, no, that's its natural form. Don't worry about it.
Just to add to that with my remake casting, Susan Sarandon is Blaze.
Like, Susan Sarandon trying too hard to come on. Blaze. Yeah, no, it works. It very much works. Everything about Blaze very much is like older, trying hard to associate with the kids, especially when she puts the punk collar on and you're just like, ha! You're trying so hard. And now all I can see is Susan Sarandon trying way too hard to be like an e-girl.
Oh my god, yes.
Yeah, I need to see that. Or like a club kid from the emo days.
Like I was just looking at Blaze over the course of the movie, and again getting those Rocky Horror vibes. I'm like, I'm sorry, you are Susan Sarandon and I will not be told different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, now I'm going to just picture her that way for the rest of my days. Such a good movie, such a good soundtrack, such a great selection of performances from relative unknowns, such a smart script from people who, once again, like this is a canon film. It didn't need to. No one was expecting. Canon didn't need quality. It's canon. They're just going to release it. We don't fucking care. It's not done. I don't care. This is canon, no. God damn it. And yet, gem.
I mean, yeah, like, if you see the names Golan and Globus on the opening credits, you are going to be in for a good time. These are the rules. We didn't make them. This is just how it works.
Yeah, I mean, it's like seeing Dino De Laurentiis, and you just go, ha 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 ha, yes, even if it's shit, it's gonna be so bad, so good.
Like, these are the men who, if I remember correctly, would get the poster for a movie design before they had the movie, sell the movie on the poster, and then go into production.
Yeah, which is why the posters from this era of B and schlock grade films are so goddamn good, because they're the selling aspect of the entire concept. It's not just selling it to the fucking consumer. It's selling the very fucking film, even to like sometimes the writer.
Yep.
And this one has a beautiful hand painted cover that is just, it's the killer slashing through a calendar, but it has that feeling to it of like, oh God, yes, this is slasher golden age cover, like poster. It's fantastic. I'm surprised that there is not a skeleton in a cheerleader outfit on it.
That might be the only horror cliche that this movie does not at least touch.
Yeah, Yeah, there's no moment when the punks like run against a bunch of like preppy girls and the two groups clash, and then like inevitably a bunch of the punks get murdered and a bunch of the preppy girls get murdered, and then at the end it's just like two punks and two preppy girls trying to survive.
Yeah.
Could have done that. Nope.
No, I mean, why? I mean,
no need.
You had an entire sequence at a drive-in that I'm convinced is only there so that they could do the standard virgin and his girlfriend in the backseat, and he's desperately trying to get laid.
Yeah, the setup is so obvious that you ignore how strained it is. In terms of connection to the rest of the fucking plot, you just go, yeah, okay. All right. Well, sure. Do it.
Yeah, it's like you don't need this at all, but fuck it.
That's definitely this entire film. You don't need this film, but fuck it.
No, like this, you don't even need to sit down and actually watch this film. This is the film that, if you're having a New Year's party, you have this playing in the background.
Or at least the soundtrack.
At least.
Yeah. And once again, no, I can't stop singing the praises of the soundtrack. It is undeniably really good if you like late 70s, early 80s alternative music. It's not great. It's not fantastic, and you're not necessarily going to go out and try to find either of the band's discography. But for what it is, it's a god damn it. You are undeservingly enjoyable. And then the movie starts appreciating on you. And that's how it starts. The bad taste.
with the song itself, it was another one of those. I had always heard about it. I heard about how good it was, but I never heard the song. And then as soon as those opening guitar riffs hit, I'm just like, yeah, just mainline it. Just give me this right here.
What a great find, man. Like, seriously, I had completely spaced on this film. I was like, slasher for New Year's. This is gonna be real cheesy. And it were.
Yeah.
But it was good.
Oh, you know, like I said, this should not work. And yet,
so well. It almost makes me wonder if the next one that we see will live up to it.
First of all, since I already know I'm going to tag Junk Food Cinema when I put this on Twitter, Brian, Cargill, on the off chance you guys actually are listening, thank you. Now, next up, we actually have two possibilities because I had an original plan, and then the trailer for something that just opened dropped. I'm like, I kind of also want to do that.
Mm.
So originally, the movie Slipstream started starring Mark Hamill had started trending for like a week, maybe two, for some reason, either late last year, early this year. And I was thinking about doing that. I don't know. Like, that's why I was thinking about doing it. Just the curiosity. Again, I gotta know. And then all of a sudden I discovered that the new Gerard Butler movie, Plane, was a thing. And I'm kind of going, I'm actually hearing good things about this Gerard Butler movie that received, like, at least out here, no promotion whatsoever.
Yeah, it looks like every other Gerard Butler movie, but with less of a budget, and yet for some reason people are just like, nah, this is it. This is the one. We finally found it. We found the Gerard zone.
So I'm sitting here like, I don't know which one I want to do.
Well, then we'll just have to do both.
Yeah, why not?
Hey.
Yes, I think we'll do Plane first, and then we can do Slipstream. And then I believe by that point we'll be hitting February, which, because it's my birthday month, oh, I'm going to have me some fun.
Oh, no.
Oh, I have a few in mind that are actually really good ones, and at least one where, yeah, you should probably worry.
Oh, no. Well, if you have any prayers for me, listeners, send them on in.
And make no mistake, she's going to need them, and you can send them to realgeekshfx@gmail.com. Or if, like most of conservative social media, you like to keep your thoughts and prayers brief, we can also be reached on Twitter at realgeekshfx. I can be reached directly at the Maritime Lord on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Hive, although admittedly I haven't bothered to check Hive in a fair while now, like probably most other people on Hive. Yeah. Or you can email me at themaritimelord@gmail.com.
And I can be found at Friday in Halifax on Twitter and at Crash and Burn everywhere else. Yeah. I think I'm on Hive, but yeah, no, I haven't checked it since I signed out the first time. I don't know.
You're on Hive. You're on Hive.
Oh, whether social media, you're just not good.
And on that note, and since I'm impressed that my voice has held out this long, it's time to sign off.
Good night, everyone, and we'll see you next time on The Real Geek.